The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. Hi, and welcome to a new bonus episode of Undisclosed, The Halls of Power. My name is Rabia Chaudhary, and I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. This week, my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller won't be joining us, but don't worry, they'll be back next week. Now, when Susan, Colin, and I began Undisclosed, we really had no idea how far and wide our reach would become. Over the past year, our audience has grown larger and larger, and we're being listened to by people of all walks of life. I don't necessarily think it's because we're extraordinary. I think it's because we're at a moment in time when the criminal justice system is coming under intense and needed public scrutiny. Adnan's case has become a vehicle through which millions are realizing the many failings in the system. But of course, long before Serial and Undisclosed, long before anyone knew who Adnan Syed was, advocates, activists, and lawyers have been fighting for justice for decades. Many such people have reached out to us to say thank you for helping make people care about the kind of work they've been doing for years. It's really humbling to be thanked by people who actually deserve our thanks. And of all such people, I was most surprised to hear from, totally out of the blue, a sitting U.S. congressman. Congressman Keith Ellison of the 5th District of Minnesota reached out to me a few months ago to express his support for Undisclosed and the awareness that we're helping to bring to the pressing need of criminal justice reform. Congressman Ellison comes to these issues after almost two decades of practice as a criminal defense attorney and a long career of public service centered on social justice. He also happens to be a podcaster and very notably has made history. That's because the Honorable Keith Ellison is the very first American Muslim to ever be elected to U.S. Congress. First of all, Congressman Ellison, thank you so much for joining us on Undisclosed. It's a real honor to have you on the show.
The honor's all mine. Thank you very much, Robbie. I listen, and I think you guys got a wonderful podcast. Very informative.
You know, when I think you first reached out to me a couple of months ago, and it was just out of the blue. I think I was making dinner, and I got a call, and it was you saying, "Is this Rabia?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh!" I was really blown out of the water, and really, really honored that you actually listened to Undisclosed and you're following Adnan's case. It means a lot.
Well, may I just say that I think that there's a whole sea change in terms of approaching criminal justice in the United States. Very dramatic shift away from the 1990s, lock them up, expand the number of people in prison. But we still have very real, very live vestiges of that old status quo system, and we really have not really come into a new reality yet. We're still a mass incarceration state. And I tell you, so often these issues are kind of cast as either poor folks' issues or more often black people or brown people's issues. And when I say brown, I mean Latino. Mm-hmm. And I thought that Adnan's case was very interesting because I believe that he was deprived of a fair trial because of his religion and his ethnicity. And I think assumptions were made. It's very clear that stereotypes were promoted. And it's very clear that the criminal justice system sort of conspired to get him. And he's also young, 17, when he was convicted. Right. And it's a way, in my opinion, your show is a way to be able to talk to the Muslim community about why we need to talk about criminal justice reform beyond surveillance, beyond some of these setup trials that a lot of Muslims go through with the sort of entrapment sort of thing, beyond national security. I mean, it is a problem all of us better plug our heads into because, you know, our advocacy will determine whether or not we'll have a just criminal justice system or not.
No, absolutely. And, I'm really glad you brought attention to this issue. A couple of weeks ago, we were together at an event, at a gala with this Muslim organization. And Congressman Allison pointed out the fact that a lot of at least advocacy and activism from the Muslim community is around other types of issues, civil rights issues, but there's very little attention given to criminal justice because I think we feel like we're not implicated in that. And that in and of itself is a problem that we think if it's not about us, we don't care. So I really appreciate the attention. But, this is not like you are new at this game. I didn't realize, actually, that you, before public service, you were a criminal defense attorney.
I was a criminal defense attorney for 16 years. I also did Section 1983 litigation in excessive force cases against police. So, I really know, I feel much more like a trial lawyer than a politician. I know a lot of people who I work with think of me as this congressman guy, but actually, I spent many more years in the courts of Minnesota and the federal courts all over the country trying to make sure that there was fair justice for all.
What kind of criminal defense did you practice? Did you work on it was state level practice or did you do federal practice?
I did both of those, and I did the appellate practice too. In state court, everything from DUIs to drug cases to assault cases, murder, everything on down. Tried many cases before juries, federal as well. As a matter of fact, I tell you this, only a few months before my primary in 2006, when I was running for Congress the first time in June of that year, and the primary was in September, I was in a murder trial. I was campaigning and trying this murder case. I always thought that the issues in the that I was going to have to deal with when I ran for Congress were going to be around some of the defendants that I had to represent. I was prepared to argue the Sixth Amendment guarantees everybody a right to a counsel, but my religion ended up overshadowing all of that. So, but yeah, I've represented many people in drug cases, assault cases, homicide cases, drive-by shootings, gang-involved cases, cases involving multiple defendants. Just kind of the whole gambit.
It's a really broad spectrum. And I'm just going to assume that you didn't. I mean, I know as a Muslim attorney myself, you end up having a really heavy Muslim client load, at least I did. But I'm assuming that didn't necessarily hold true for
No,
you.
I represented plenty of Muslims, but because I was a contract public defender, so I was on the CJA panel, and I got federal cases that way sometimes, and I got retained as well. And then I also had a public defender conflicts panel contract for a while. So I got a lot of people, a lot of Somali people I represented that way. And then I got Muslims who retained me to represent them. But then went up for 5 years between 1993 to 1998. I was director of something called the Legal Rights Center, which is basically a public defense office. So we only represented who came through the door. We didn't really pick our clients. For a while there was this substance called CHAT or CAT. It is a controlled substance. It's like a bush
I
that
know
originates
exactly.
in East Africa. And a lot of Somalis were being prosecuted for possession of cat. And so I actually had my fair share of those cases, and we challenged, those prosecutions on the basis of there being no active ingredient, of a controlled substance in there. It's just basically all had dissipated. So we fought that. Yeah, I actually represented a fair number of Muslims out there.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the issue of I've never known how to pronounce it either, cat, but because that had major implications with immigration clients who are coming from that region because it is so commonly used. People just chew it like tobacco or whatever. But if you were found to have it in your system or ever have used it, you are actually barred from visa. Like even if your spouse is sponsoring you, if you chew that stuff, you weren't allowed to come to the country. It was really tough, and there was no way around it for us immigration
Well, as
attorneys.
you know, whenever you have a criminal defense case, you better be very careful if they're a naturalized citizen or if they're a non-citizen because, you could end up with in a deportation situation. Even if you have a citizen, I had a case one time where they were trying to get my client to rescind his citizenship because they said he lied on some of his naturalization forms and were trying to get him to literally give up his U.S. citizenship. And so, those cases where you got immigration and criminal justice matters can be pretty dicey if you're not watching out.
Yeah, you have to be careful on those. You began your public office career in 2002, though, right? I mean, with your election to the Minnesota House of Representatives.
That's right. That's my first foray into electoral politics.
Right. I
But I was
wanted
active
to.
in politics before that, not as a candidate, but I was pushing the city council in Minneapolis to have a civilian review authority. I was arguing and testifying at the state legislature to make sure that they did not overreact in the war on drugs. I mean, so I would testify on policy issues, but I really didn't like or trust politicians until it became very clear to me that somebody was going to be in there, and you know, it ought to be somebody I agree with.
And like you.
So, well, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what propelled you to then run for office. Is just realizing that, you know, to make the kind of changes you wanted to see, you had to actually be in that door.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's
you
right.
know,
that's why I ran.
Yeah. Well, you have been a member of the
U.S.
Congress.
And that's why I hope you run one of these days.
Oh, God. No, that is totally. You know,
come on, Rabia.
Absolutely not.
As soon as the kids get a little older, you can do it.
I'm waiting for Adnan to get out so I can just like take off and disappear and relax for a bit. You know what? It's the work of elected public office is incredibly grueling. I really admire, you know, people like you who take it on, and it's exhausting. I'm here to support you, but thank you. I'll stick to podcasting. but I want to talk about, you know, you were elected to U.S. Congress in 2006, so it's been almost a decade. And it seems like from the get-go, you were really interested in introducing criminal justice was on your mind. In 2007, you introduced something called the Second Chances Act, I believe.
Absolutely.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the Second Chance Act, you know, that's really about, you know, we have this massive number of people who are incarcerated, and we need to have a reentry system so that people do not become repeat customers in the criminal justice system. We need to have a reentry system that connects the incarcerated people with their families, with potential job opportunities, helps reacclimate them to what it means to be free and on the outside again. And so there was a lot of efforts in the Second Chance Act to help make that happen. Yeah, but there have been a lot of other things. You know, there's one piece of legislation I'm excited about now called the Reset Act, bipartisan, bicameral legislation that would reclassify low-level nonviolent drug possession felonies as misdemeanors. It would eliminate the distinction between crack and powder cocaine, which you know now is 18 to 1. It used to be 100 to 1, and ensure that food products containing drugs are weighed fairly. You know, and then there's the Justice is Not for Sale Act, which would ban private prisons, reinstate federal parole system, and eliminate quotas for the number of immigrants held in detention. You know, we were just talking about immigration. You know that there's this federal mandate that there needs to be at least like 34,000 ICE detention beds available on any given night.
It's crazy.
So they built in their market. You know, it's really kind of the financial aspect of this thing is really, really scandalous.
I mean, it is definitely an industry. Prison industrial complex, this is an entire industry. People are profiting in the millions, maybe billions on this. I want to talk a little bit about the Reset Act. So this is federal legislation that you are, where is it in the legislative kind of process right now?
Well, you know, we've got Republicans on it, and Democrats, we've got senators and House members, and we're trying to move it forward. There is another vehicle which would lower some mandatory minimums, but it would also lower the mens rea on some white-collar crimes, and I'm not too excited to do that. So, but the Reset Act, whether the vehicle is the Reset Act or another one, there is, in fact, a growing consensus, even among very conservative Republicans and very liberal Democrats and everyone in between, that we have got to lower and get rid of mandatory minimum sentence.
Right.
So the Reset Act is there. It's informing and helping to drive the overall debate. At the end of the day, if we can get a bill through this year, which the administration definitely wants, recently Valerie Jarrett came to the Progressive Caucus, which I co-chair, to talk about the president's advocacy here. You know, we talked about, you know, the importance of moving a bill through. It may or may not be the Reset Act at the end of the day, but the principles in it will be there. We're just trying to make sure that as we lower some of these nonviolent drug sentencing felonies penalties, that we also don't lower the mens rea that must be proved for certain financial crimes, because that would mean that the Wall Street, you know, fraudsters get to walk away by saying, well, you can't prove that I knew this was going to destroy the economy, so you can't convict
me. Right. And for our listeners, mens rea means basically it's your intention of where you were when you committed the crime. What was your intent behind it? The bill to ban private prisons, is it legislation that's like for a complete ban on federal private prisons, or how does that operate? And is that also bipartisan?
Yeah, it would simply say that through the, it's not bipartisan, but it's bicameral. So it's me and Bernie Sanders are the chief authors on that. And what we're saying is that, you know, the United States federal government buys more stuff than anyone in the world.
Right.
And through our procurement power, we can simply decide we will not contract with a private prison corporation. And I think we should not do it. I think that if you ever lock up somebody, the only consideration should be justice, not stockholders, not profitability. That should never enter the dialogue. And yet, when you enter have a private prison, that's part of the consideration for the private prison. We should hold liberty so sacred that we would never deprive anybody of it unless it was necessary for the ends of justice, for public safety. Once you introduce the private motive, I think you're heading down a dangerous path. So that's something that Bernie and I believe we just shouldn't do. It is a core function of government to incarcerate and deprive citizens of liberty, and only justice can be the proper consideration when you do that, not money.
I know one of the motivations for, or one of the arguments for private prisons was actually it would lower the financial burden on government, but I don't think that's actually true. I think they actually
right.
cost us more. They cost taxpayers a lot more.
You're right, Robbie. They cost taxpayers about $80 billion.
Wow.
You know? So, I mean, they're very expensive.
They're expensive, and the fact that, you know, and I want to talk a little bit, I want to talk a lot about your podcast, which is really just phenomenal. It's called We the Podcast. For anybody who's interested in social justice issues, Congressman Allison talks about a whole array of social justice issues, but there are three or four episodes specifically about criminal justice, the kinds of challenges people who are incarcerated face. One thing you mentioned was that there's been a 500% increase in incarceration. I don't know since what time, but what was really interesting for me to hear, beyond that being horrifying, was that there isn't a corresponding increase in crime. So then how do you get an increase in incarceration? Can you explain that?
Well, I think that what's really happening here is the financial considerations. You know, you have people coming down to the Hill, including unions that represent guards and the financial sector, and people who have contracts with even public prisons, all who now have a financial stake in the status quo of this massive incarceration. Also, rural communities where factories have maybe closed down and moved abroad, they might do economic development by trying to attract a prison to their community. So now they are hooked into the system of incarceration. So, you know, I think that the combination of a financialization of the criminal justice process with the war on drugs has led to this dramatic increase. And I think that we just never really considered, you know, what the bed impact and the expense was going to be on people. And much of this is also, racialized. I mean, just recently, you know, the Congress had a very thoughtful conversation about how to address opioid addiction, heroin, and even illegal painkillers. And it was interesting how we talked about this. We did all these things to try to address this problem. But what we did not do is double sentences for people who had heroin. What we did not do is, you know, create whole new police agencies to fight heroin.
Right.
And the reason why is a lot of the people who are victims of this are white, you know, and I'm not saying that that's the only reason, but there is no question that when we thought of crack as a black thing in the 90s, we dealt with it with prisons, with increasing sentences, with more cops, with front-end loaders, with military-style responses. And here, with the opioids, because, you know, of who's being hurt, the response is very different. Now, one of the things I said during the course of the debate is, look, I hope it's not a racial thing. I hope it's because we've just learned, right, that you cannot solve a social medical problem with a criminal justice response. But if it's true that the reason we're handling the opioid addiction differently, then why aren't we going back to kind of correct some of the problems that our prior response caused with regard to crack/cocaine? We are sort of talking about it, but we're not doing it nearly enough. There are still about 2.4 million people behind bars, and it has gotten shockingly casual and easy to hand out, you know, 60 months, 120 months, 180 months, you know, which is in the routine, and particularly in federal court.
Wow. Well, you know, the conversations that are happening, you said that you are seeing kind of a real dramatic shift in these conversations, even across a political spectrum. So in your last decade in Congress, what do you think is driving that shift?
Well, I think that, I mean, when I talk to my conservative friends, they basically mention two things. One is that if you want to look at big government oppressing the individual, look at the criminal justice system, right, and how it treats people. I mean, in Adnan's case, basically you got a 17-year-old kid up against an entire police department, all who has the power to pressure witnesses, the power to withhold evidence, the power to you know, do a whole range of things. And they also have the presumption and the prestige where a juror will figure, well, if the government says this, it's probably right, you know. So from a conservative standpoint, they're looking at that, just the power of the government. The other thing is, it's expensive. $40,000 per person per year, that's pretty expensive, and they want to lower the cost of government and then hand it all back in tax cuts. Hard to do if you're locking up all these people.
Right.
And then on the liberal end of the equation, we agree that the human cost is just devastating, that it violates equal protection, that there's disproportionate number of people of color being hurt in this system, and that we're just throwing away human potential. So we kind of meet there. Now, the conversation has not resulted in the real fruits that we're looking for, but we're doing something that we've never done before. We're really talking about it and saying we need to reform it. I'm telling you, in the 1990s, Rabia, it was all about being tough on crime.
Right.
You had to be tough on crime. You had to promote longer sentences and harsher punishments and all the people who are just put in solitary confinement. I mean, we really, really went overboard, and we're sort of finding our way back, but not nearly fast enough. One of the things I wanted to mention in the podcast is that there might be 2.4 million people behind bars in the United States, but there's 2.7 million children whose parents are behind bars, mm-hmm. which means that the financial impact to the family of a member being incarcerated is dramatic and devastating. And we have never really considered the debilitating aspects of a person trying to make a living after they get out of prison. 97% of all prisoners are going to get out.
There are things that people really don't even realize the kind of impacts that have. And you did an entire episode on just making a phone call from prison, what that
right.
means to a family and to an incarcerated person. But before we talk about that issue, I do want to talk a little bit about the podcast and how it came about
sure.
and why you decided to. I mean, it seems like you are using the podcast as a vehicle to talk about social justice issues, from economic justice, racial justice, criminal justice. How did that come about?
Well, the core of the podcast is how working people relate to the economy. So if you tune on nightly news and you just, you know, okay, so now the economic section is going to come on, they may tell you about the Dow Jones Industrial Average. They may tell you whether NASDAQ is up or down. They may or may not mention something about the unemployment rate, but that's pretty much it. They're not telling you that if you have a loved one who's incarcerated, that you may be spending as much as $14 a minute just to have a phone call with a loved one who's incarcerated. You may have to pay money to put money on their books, you know, which is kind of crazy. You may have to drive miles and miles, perhaps even get on an airplane if you want to go visit a loved one. And so this is an economic question at the end of the day, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, if you have a loved one who's incarcerated, there is a financial impact which is measurable to the family. And we talk about payday lending. We talk about the right to organize a union and collective bargaining. We talk about, you know, what happens if you try to form a union and you're retaliated against by your employer, what your rights are and how quickly you might be able to get some relief. And we talk about zero waste. If we want to go green in our economy, what does that mean in terms of employment, recycling, composting? So we try to cover the gambit, and we had a whole session about how the Supreme Court decision that impact individual economic choices, right? So like the Lilly Ledbetter case, this is a woman, white woman from Alabama, worked 30 years, did a great job, had excellent reviews, but was consistently paycheck after paycheck after paycheck paid less than men because she was female. Mm-hmm. And that meant she had a smaller retirement, and that's reality. And the Supreme Court said that they could do that to her, even though a jury of men and women heard her case, found that she was a victim of discrimination and awarded her money. They found that after the statute of limitations started running after the first incident of discrimination and she couldn't recover anything after that, even though the work rules said that they could withhold how much other people were making from her, that information. So she never even knew that she was getting paid less till she got to retirement. But they're saying she should have known way back, and they cut her award down to a minuscule amount. So that's the economic impact on people, like, you know, Harris versus Quinn and the right to organize public employee unions. Mm-hmm. You know, the Supreme Court makes a lot of decisions about people's economic viability. So that's right. really what it's all about. Call We the Podcast. You can sign up on iTunes or on SoundCloud.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend it. I've learned a lot just from like the 4 or 5 episodes I've listened to. And what's really excellent is that you bring on leading experts on the issues to come and have a discussion on it. So there's a lot to learn there. So, you know, all this legislation that you're talking about and this shift in the conversation, you know, kind of because the level which you work with is kind of a really, really like high level, right? And it's going to impact on the federal level, federal prisons, all these things. But then how does that end up reflecting then on the state level? We know most people who are incarcerated in state prisons. So would federal legislation have any impact other than maybe kind of informing a shift in public discourse, kind of pushing people a certain way?
Yeah.
How do we make these things realities on the ground?
Well, you know, thanks for pointing that out, because the federal government can do what it wants to do. The state doesn't have to follow.
Right.
The fact is that usually this federal government is a leading indicator. I mean, a lot of times, you know, when Lynn Bias died from a crack overdose back in the 1989, the federal government doubled sentencing and then states followed suit. And perhaps the way it'll change, hopefully will change, and maybe states will follow suit or will follow state example. But the federal government can also do things like say, unless you will comply with certain standards, that you won't be eligible for certain federal grants. Actually, I'm working on legislation now that looks at police departments that have a particularly bad relationship with their communities, and to say that, you know, this may impact your eligibility for burn and JAG grants. Mm. These are law enforcement type grants. You know, just try to incentivize them to work more constructively with the communities that they're sworn to protect and serve.
Well, that's going to be very interesting to follow, because I'm trying to imagine how it would be even measured and gauged what their relationship
is like.
That'll
but we might need your advice. I mean, but if you look at a lot of police departments around this country, they've been under, like, federal monitoring. They've been under,
right.
I mean, federal government has tried, like in Ferguson, for example, done investigations on them, put them under federal supervision. It's actually tough to change that culture. So, for example, in Adnan's case, you know, there was one episode where you just heard the interrogation of Jay and how they just seemed to guide his testimony so carefully. You know, to me, that's a police accountability issue, right? It does apply in multiple numbers of ways, just in terms of how witnesses are interrogated, what information is given to them, the coaching that they may receive to help the police build a case before they even turn it over to a prosecutor.
Right.
Kind of a complicated set of circumstances.
I think, you know, one of the biggest frustrations is the lack of accountability when it comes to kind of, you know, these types of cases, wrongful convictions, or for whatever reason that wrongful conviction happened, whether it was police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, or just poor investigation. You know, you will often see, what's interesting is you'll, in a place like Baltimore, but a lot of different cities, you'll see patterns. So you'll see like the same detectives over and over appear in the same kinds of cases, which seems to indicate a pattern of corruption, but there's no accountability. We have videotape footage of police officers just killing Black men in the middle of the street. There's no accountability.
Right.
And that lack of accountability, even with the DOJ being involved, still doesn't seem like enough to me, at least.
You need a social justice movement behind this kind of stuff.
Right.
You can change it, but you can't just change it because it's wrong. You're going to have to get large numbers of people demanding this change. You're going to have to start getting politicians who are willing to stand up and say, I'm going to take on the police union. This is what's needed.
This is a perfect segue, actually, kind of to my last big question for you. And that is this, like, how do you get people to care? This is really the most difficult part of all these issues, whether it's the Muslim community, which other than criminal justice for years, I tried very hard to get the Muslim community interested in immigration reform issues. And oddly enough, they're not that interested. But getting people incentivized is hard. And so I would love your advice on how do we, if we want to help propel a social justice movement, I mean, it's becoming very apparent, like, how broken the system is. But getting people to move on that is hard. What's your advice?
Well, my advice is, first of all, you got to tell people about it. When you go and you talk to people about it, they probably have experienced something similar to themselves, and often that will propel them to action. But the thing is, so many people suffer in silence when it comes to this kind of stuff. They think they're isolated and alone. So if you will just lead like you've been doing, people will be attracted to you. I think that you have some experiences of this in your own life, Rabia, where just you getting out there and doing something, people will then, they'll come to you and they'll say, you know what, I'm supporting what you're doing because I've seen something like this in my own life. And, you know, but people suffer so often in silence and alone, and they feel like, well, what did I do? For example, I was at a meeting recently with the Second Chance Coalition in Minneapolis, which is where I live. And one of the things that all of the family members of incarcerated people said is that we've always felt like we were suffering alone. We've always felt like we were walking this lonely mile by ourselves. And we were always halfway embarrassed that we had a loved one in prison and didn't want to talk about it that much. But having a group like this makes us feel like we're not alone, and that there is somebody who will hold our hand through this. That is how social justice movements are built. If I could just take you back to the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott movement, how many people had suffered indignities on the buses due to racism, right? How many people had been mistreated by this particular bus driver, had to give up their seat to a white person or whatever? Well, you know what? For years it went on, and most people just moved and hated it, but they just moved. But then one day, Rosa Parks says, "I'm not moving," and it sets off a whole movement. Because I really do got to tell you this, Robbie, I think people do care. I just think they don't know what to do about it. They don't have any confidence that anything they do will make a difference. So when Arabia Chaudhry gets up there and says, "I'm doing a podcast and I'm going to fight to get this person their liberty back," your courage is contagious, you know? And it spreads. Yeah. And people start feeling like, wow, you know, maybe there's hope to be had here. If she has hope, maybe there is hope.
Well, that's really, really kind of you. I mean, your work is extraordinary. And, you know, I'm going to continue to share the work you're doing. You know, any type of resource, obviously, we could offer to you to help move some of this legislation through or to get awareness about it. I think it's really important because all of these pieces fit together, like you said, from the Supreme Court decisions to legislation to, like, it filters down. And we have to remember that these things work together and we can't work in silos on these.
I just want to say this, Rabia. Thank you so much for doing Undisclosed, and thank you for fighting for Adnan Syed. And I just want to say that it doesn't help the memory of Haymon Lee to have the wrong person in prison, right? It's better for the truth to really come out, and that's what you've been fighting for. So thank you so much for standing up for truth without regard to anything else. Just saying, we're going to fight for the truth. So I really am praying for a good outcome, still waiting with bated breath on the judge's decision.
By the way, I spoke to Adnan a few days ago, and I told him that you sent your regards and prayers, and he also sends his.
Well, that makes me feel good.
Hopefully one day you guys will get to meet. Thank you so much, Congressman.
All right. Well.
They say all politics is local, and I think it's fair to say all advocacy is too. Many people ask what they can do to help make change in the system, and I remind them that they have to start within their states and to work with and pressure their local elected officials for reform that is meaningful and just. Change happens from the ground up. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.